This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Author Wiley Cash was this year's Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence at Shepherd University. His newest novel, The Last Ballad, will be released tomorrow. Last week, Liz McCormick sat down with Cash to discuss his latest work. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
Thank you, Wiley, so much for joining us. It is great to be with you today. I understand in your newest novel, The Last Ballad, that you explore a few different social issues, such as labor issues, racism, and sexism. And your book takes place in 1929, following a single mother, Ella May, whose husband's run out on her. She's a mother of four, and she ends up joining the labor movement, which changes her life. I wanted to talk with you about some of the issues that you explore in this new novel. Why did those issues resonate with you in this story?
You know, many of the people in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina, Western North Carolina and East Tennessee, they were farmers. They were tenant farmers. They would rent a farm from a landowner and then they would try to work that farm and pay rent and try to grow enough food. So many of these people were bartering. They were bartering crops. They were bartering products. They were bartering goods. But then the economy started to change and you needed cash. You needed physical paper money and coins. So many of these people who had always relied on their own sense of a work ethic, of their own clock, they had to go into lumber camps to earn cash money to buy goods at a store. And these lumber camps were dangerous and they were dirty. And it felt as if these fiercely individual people in some ways had become disposable. Well, then these lumber camps began to close when the Great Smoky Mountains National Park came in and started federalizing some of the land. And these people had nowhere to go. They had to earn more cash money. And so many of them left the mountains and went down to the mills. When they got down to the mills, these people who are a half a generation removed from the farm suddenly find themselves in mill villages where they have neighbors with houses. They can touch the houses and walk in between the houses and touch them. They're working for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week in a mill. They're shopping in a company store. Their kids are going to a mill school. If there's a school at all, they're going to a mill church that's run by the mill. And again, they're finding themselves as disposable, tools of labor, and found themselves locked in a system of poverty they couldn't escape. And so the labor unions sense this unrest, and they sense this disappointment with life, and they sense the low economic and cultural life in these mills, and they started to organize it. And when they started to try to organize, again, these fiercely individual people said, "You want me to be part of what?" And so it was tough unionizing these mills in the South. Naturally, you get all these different types of people together. They're around African Americans for the first time. They're seeing women do the same jobs they're doing. And so as much as you're trying to get people together to join a union, to strike for higher wages, for a livable wage, to strike for safe working conditions, to strike for a 40-hour work week, it's also difficult because you're asking them to stand on the picket line with people who are not like them. And so it was a very combustible moment. And that's what my novel, The Last Ballad, is about. And the woman the novel centers on is based on a true life heroine named Ella Mae Wiggins, who grew up, was born in East Tennessee, grew up in the lumber camps in Western North Carolina, and found her way down to the mills and became the face of quite possibly one of the most important labor movements in American history.
And now why did that labor movement interest you so to want to write this novel about it?
The Laurie Mill strike took place in 1929 in Gastonia, North Carolina. And I'm from Gastonia. I was raised there. And when the strike happened in 1929, Laurie was one of the biggest mills in the country, definitely one of the biggest mills in the state. And, during this strike, it was a communist-led labor strike, like communist-led from Moscow through New York City. And they sent organizers down from New York City to Gastonia, this little mill town. And so people told these labor organizers, if you can organize the Laurie Mill, you can organize the entire South. And so they began trying to organize this mill. Well, Ella Mae Wiggins, lived 7 miles to the west in Bessemer City. She had come down from Bryson City. She'd met a no-good husband. They had lived in other mill towns in the upstate and around Gaston County. By the time of the strike, Ella Mae was living alone. Her husband had left her for the final time. She was white. She lived in a predominantly African-American community. She worked at one of the only integrated mills in the county, not because the owners were progressive, but because the pay was so low that white people would not work there. She was 28 years old. She'd given birth to 9 children. 4 of them had died from whooping cough and pellagra. She worked 72 hours a week on the night shift, and she made $9 a week. And so when these union leaflets began circulating through the mill, she reads about the demands of a $20 minimum wage. That's more than twice what she's making now. A 40-hour work week. That's almost half as much as she's working now. Equal pay for equal work across gender and racial lines. Recognition of the union. The end of piecemeal work. And so Ella said, you know, if even a few of these union demands come true, I can survive. My children can survive. And so she decided to join the strike at Loray. She walked off her job at American Mill No. 2, and she joined the strike at the Loray Mill. And she quickly became the face of the strike. She was brilliant. She was tough. She was a mountaineer. She was independent. She was determined. And she began to perform protest songs based on these ballads she had learned from her mother in Appalachia. They had lived in a lumber camp where her father was a sawyer. Her mother took in laundry, and Ella and her mother would do laundry, and they would sing ballads. And so Ella joins the strike, and she begins to change the words in these ballads to make them into protest songs. That summer in 1929, she visited Washington, D.C. and confronted North Carolina senators about labor conditions in the South. She integrated the labor union. She performed these protest ballads. And the more attention she got for the labor movement, the more dangerous she became to the mill owners. So in September of that year, of 1929, there was a huge protest rally organized in support of these jailed strikers who had been jailed for and were awaiting trial for the police chief's murder. And Ella was in a convoy of strikers leaving Bessemer City. And they were turned around, her caravan was turned around by a roadblock of people hired by the mill. So Ella Mae's convoy, all of whom were unarmed, they turned around and went back to Bessemer City. And soon the men who had set up the roadblock followed them, ran them off the road, and then fired into the overturned vehicles on the side of the road. And Ella was shot, and she died at the scene. And her children were whisked away to an orphanage. And Ella Mae Wiggins and the story of the Loray Mill strike literally disappeared from history. I was raised in Gastonia, and I never heard a word of Ella Mae Wiggins, never heard of the Loray Mill strike. When she was murdered, it made the headlines of newspapers around the world, not just in Gastonia, not just the state, but just as quickly as it was sensationalized and covered, it was just as quickly swallowed up. And I didn't know about the Loray Mill strike until I went to graduate school in Louisiana in 2003, and a professor heard that I was from Gastonia, and he said, oh, the Loray Mill strike. And I thought, what's the Loray Mill strike? And so I did a little research and was shocked by this incredible story that had been hidden from me and hidden from most people in Gaston County for, you know, almost 100 years.
Thank you very much, Wiley Cash. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was author Wiley Cash speaking with reporter Liz McCormick. Cash's newest novel, The Last Ballad, hits bookstores tomorrow. Visit our website, wvpublic.org, to hear an extended version of this interview. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. Some areas of fog this morning, becoming mostly sunny, highs in the 70s, clear skies overnight with lows in the 40s, mostly sunny Tuesday with highs in the 70s and low 80s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com. As the toll from the addiction crisis rises, some 60 government bodies around the Ohio Valley are suing companies that make or distribute opioid painkillers. It's a trend that recalls the legal strategy that led to the landmark tobacco industry settlement. Aaron Payne reports on the search for a legal remedy to this epidemic.
Please join me in giving them one more round of applause.
When healthcare and law enforcement officials met recently to share ideas about the opioid crisis, Kentucky's Attorney General Andy Beshear listed some groups that benefited from money in a 2015 settlement with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin.
We had Freedom House in Louisville and Independence House in Corbin. We had the Chrysalis House here in Lexington, Hope in the Mountains that was going to have to shut down in Prestonsburg.
Then Beshear doubled down on a commitment to sue other opioid manufacturers and distributors. He claims they owe the people affected by the addiction crisis.
I'm not looking for punishment. I'm looking for responsibility. And if those companies won't take responsibility, then I'm going to see them in court.
Beshear joins a trend of state, county, and municipal governments across the country filing myriad lawsuits in the past year against opioid manufacturers, distributors, pharmacies, and doctors they say should take partial responsibility for the addiction crisis. The approximately 60 plaintiffs in the Ohio Valley range from the state of Ohio, population 11 million, to the town of Kermit, West Virginia, population 371. These officials say the money earned in court could cover what's been spent on damage done and help improve treatment options. But some question if the courts offer the best fix for the addiction crisis. University of Kentucky law professor Richard Osnes, who researches product liability litigation, says the end goal may not require a successful ruling.
I'm not sure they expect to win or want to win. I think what they want to do is settle.
He draws a parallel to when the tobacco industry leaders agreed to pay $206 billion in 1998 after nearly every state sued to recover Medicaid dollars spent on tobacco-related disease.
The tobacco companies sort of threw in the towel and finally said, we're getting killed here a little bit at a time.
But that comparison raises another thorny question. Will the money from lawsuits really help those in need? While smoking rates have dropped since the 90s, critics of the tobacco settlement say much of the money promised to smoking prevention and education programs went instead into the state's general budgets. So far, the opioid suits show mixed results in the region. The Chrysalis House in Lexington is using some of the Purdue Pharma settlement money to help pregnant women struggling with addiction.
Providing necessary treatment and wraparound services to the women and children that we serve.
That's Executive Director Lisa Minton. The $350,000 awarded to the Residential Recovery Program for women will go toward hiring additional staff and educational parenting programs to these new mothers that come to one of their three facilities. Minton says it takes some of the pressure off finding enough funding to keep up with the increase in demand for services.
Funding is always precarious.
Kentucky's Office of Drug Control Policy Executive Director Van Ingram cautions that even big money settlements take time to show effects on the ground. The state's suit against Purdue, for example, was filed in 2007. A settlement came in 2015, and organizations are just now receiving the money.
It'll be a decade before anything results out of these lawsuits, in my opinion. There are quick settlements, but I just don't see that happening. So I don't think it's going to have any immediate impact.
The lawsuits in the Ohio Valley remain in the early stages, meaning it's still far too early to tell how they will end, and even harder to tell if the result will have any impact on the opioid crisis. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Aaron Payne.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.